Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. We are here again for another evening of Iditarod fun and games. This evening, we are also joined by Alex Stein, but also Robert Forto is back in studio, so I'm going to turn it over to the boys, and they're going to roll with the show.
Hello, first of all, Robert. Welcome back.
Yes, thank you. How are you, Alex?
I'm doing great. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's good to be back. I know you guys held down the fort, so to speak, during the last few days while we were on our expedition. We completed 209 miles with three dog teams and eight students from the local university. It was a blast, and I'm glad to be back on the show with you, Alex.
Yeah, you know, Michelle and I were talking about this a little bit a couple days ago. It sounds like you really had a lot of the even though it wasn't a dog race per se, you had a lot of the elements of a dog race. You had breaking trail, you had marking trail, you had all of the logistics that went into it in terms of, the lodges and drop bags and things like that. And then you even had a couple of drop dogs that had to be returned. So it sounds like you have really had an amazing 3 or 4 days.
It was awesome. The weather was
perfect.
And
we had a great time out on the trail. We did take three teams, so it was like running three races at once. And I couldn't ask for a better week with a bunch of new friends. And I'm glad we were able to complete that and get back into the swing of things with our Iditarod coverage. And what's happening? You know, all I know is Mitch won the race. Other than that, I'm out of the loop.
Well, you know, we've been talking for a few days about what an incredibly fast race this is. And looking at the statistics right now, we have 42 teams that have already finished. So
wow.
that is an astonishingly fast race. Among the highlights, as you mentioned, Mitch won, setting a couple of records. One more time, the oldest musher to win the race. Also, he shattered the record time by, I believe, more than 6 hours.
Wow.
Jesse Royer came in fifth, top woman finisher, and came in with all 16 of her dogs in harness, and they looked great. She also just finished the Yukon Quest, and she only dropped two dogs there. So to do 2,000-mile races and only drop two dogs in the entire time is pretty remarkable. Allie Zirkel, who was my pick to come in first, came in eighth, had some problems with a stomach bug on some of her dogs. We talked a little bit about Jeff King, who had made a very public announcement a few days ago that this was going to be his worst Iditarod ever, and he was sort of going to hang back and enjoy himself. And then he just put on the afterburners and wound up coming in 11th, nearly came in 10th, just missed that by a little under an hour. And he said he had a great fourth quarter, sort of like a Tom Brady fourth quarter. We also had Robert Reddington managed to come in as the Rookie of the Year in 22nd place. So we had three Reddingtons in the top 25, which is pretty remarkable. Robert was sort of trading the lead back and forth with Sebastian Verneau for who would be the fastest rookie, and Robert wound up beating him by almost an hour. Just was able to turn it on in the last part of the race. We had two scratches today. Monica Zappa scratched in Shaq Tulik. Apparently the sea ice there is very rough and jagged, and her dogs just didn't want to go out on it. And after trying for a while, she realized that this wasn't going to happen, and she scratched. And then this afternoon, Roger Lee scratched on the way into Shaktulik. So we've still got a field of 64, which is a pretty amazing field. We've got a few five teams still in Koyuk, but everyone else is either in White Mountain or headed to White Mountain, and it is starting to look from just from the standings and where everyone is and the run rest cycles, like we could have the Red Lantern come in as early as Saturday morning.
You know, that's pretty amazing that's going to happen. You know, I know when Cindy Abbott came in, I think it was on the same route, wasn't it, when she pulled in, or was that last year? She pulled in right during the banquet, and it was a very fast time then. Was that last year or the year before?
I believe that was last year, but let me just check that really quickly. That was 2015, so that was the same route.
The same route. That's what I thought. So, yeah, this is definitely a much faster trail. Like I said, we traveled up the river here, and it was an absolutely beautiful week here in Alaska. The sun was out, blue skies. We could see Denali every day. And I would imagine even up a little further north, they had great weather along the Iditarod Trail. So you had mentioned, Alex, that we had 64 people still competing in the race, with a good majority of those guys, 49 or so had finished already, or at least in White Mountain, 42.
Yeah,
42
we've got
finished,
49 in White Mountain, and I believe 42 have finished already.
Yeah, that's an amazing thing. There have been a few scratches, but nothing like years past where we see, you know, a good 20% or so. It's kind of the norm for scratches in Iditarod. What do you think that is? Do you think it's weather? Do you think it's just kind of the overall pace of the race? What are your thoughts on this few scratches this late in the game?
I think a lot of it has to do with the trail. I think we've seen a trail that has been, there's always problems with the trail. There's always areas that are rougher than others, but we just seem to have seen a lot more snow on the trail this year, and we seem to have seen a trail that is faster and that is really extraordinarily well prepared for the teams this year. So I would guess that has a lot to do with it. Because we're not going through the difficult early part of the race, through the steps and the Dalzell Gorge and all of that, those are areas where people tend to, even in years when the trail is good, where teams tend to just really get beaten up. And so that every year we see people who scratch right after that, or sometimes we see people who get injured in that part of the race, and then because of those injuries are forced to scratch later on down the trail. So I think it's a combination of all of those things. It also probably doesn't hurt that it was so cold in the early part of the trail, because the mushers were really very focused on getting through the cold and on, trying to get through this as fast as they could. So there wasn't necessarily as much dawdling in the first part of the race. And boy, did that set a really, really fast pace that carried on throughout the entire length of it.
So you had mentioned off air that you had a couple of stories for today. As I said, I'm sort of out of the loop still. I guess I'll have better reporting tomorrow. But what's happening that you would like to talk about this evening?
A couple of little things. We talked about Catherine Keith a few nights ago as the musher of the day, who is engaged to John Baker, and both of them had dogs who were on their team who died. Catherine had a dog that died on the trail, and John Baker had a dog that he dropped that was actually returned to Anchorage, picked up by a handler, and then escaped from the handler's house and was struck by a car and killed. So very sad for the both of them. And they decided that as a result of this, they wanted to just stay together. So they traveled together for most of the last 250 or so miles. They were traveling right with each other. When they came up Front Street, John Baker was ahead. He stopped and waited for her, and then they basically came in together, although officially he came in a second before her. So really, you know, it's always nice to see people traveling together. Up until the Barrington twins, I'm not sure I ever saw people really finish together in that way. But it's a very nice thing to watch.
You know, I agree with you. And throughout this whole thing, I remember they were talking that during the UConn Quest, how John was waiting for Catherine and all of that. And it truly is becoming an Iditarod love story, isn't it?
It really is. And, you know, we had mentioned that in last year's race, when they agreed to get married, they decided that the person who finished ahead, the one of them who finished first, would get to pick the date. And then John finished first last year, and he has yet to set the date for them getting married. So I am thinking that with this horrible tragedy that happened to these two dogs on their teams and in their kennel, that it would not surprise me if this made them realize, yeah, what are we waiting for? Let's just set a date.
Right. Yeah, I always like hearing about that type of stuff, and it looks like it's going to work out very nicely for those guys, and I'm sure they got many more races to come.
Absolutely. There continues to be fallout from the mostly among fans talking about this controversy with the vet book, that Dallas's vet book, and I noticed when Hugh Neff came in, one of the first things he said is that he was tired of the fans arguing about this, and which I guess he heard about while he was on the trail yesterday and the day before, and that sometimes the fans just have to realize that this isn't something they need to concern themselves about, and this isn't really their fight to fight. But as we know, whenever people become fans and when they become invested in a sport or in watching a race or an event, they start to feel like they have some sort of ownership over it, and that they have some sort of right to have their opinion heard and to argue about it. And I can see both sides of this, because on the one hand, fans like to have something to talk about, but on the other hand, it's really not our race; it's the Mushers' race, and I think that's a really, really good point. And Hugh pointed out when he finished that a lot of people aren't necessarily entering Iditarod because they want to win; they're entering Iditarod because they have this great relationship with these amazing athletes who are the dogs, and they want to be able to spend this special time with the dogs in, you know, some of the most beautiful parts of the world.
You know, I agree. And just like you said, with any other sport, it's difficult to pull yourself away as a competitor and or as a fan, because that line is very easily crossed, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is, and especially now that Iditarod is trying to Iditarod as an organization is trying to I don't know what the right phrase is, but they're trying to present themselves in a way that they can really move to the next level, and for some people they think, well, this isn't Joe Reddington's race, and they're not using their snowshoes, and they're not really breaking trail. And yes, the race has changed a lot, But as we talk about frequently, this is an enormously expensive endeavor for the mushers, for the ITC, for everyone. And in order to be able to continue doing it, they need to be able to get more support, to get more sponsors, and in some ways that is going to change it and is going to make it, you know, maybe something that's a little bit more television friendly, that's a little bit more appealing to advertisers who aren't necessarily Alaska based. So while I definitely see Hugh's point, and I definitely, you know, would always respect what the mushers want and how this race is the mushers' race, if the ITC really wants to take it to the next level, they are going to have to figure out some way that they can, accommodate sort of the wants and needs of the fans as well.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, Alex. What are your thoughts to that? What do you hope to see in the future if they do change?
Yeah, you know, I would like to see it change as little as possible. Part of what I love about Iditarod is that it is a distinctly Alaskan event, and it's not slick, and it's not like every other sporting event you see. And there have been some things that have happened that have moved it more towards being like most other sporting events. That bothers me a little bit, but I realize that some of that is necessary. I'd like to see it remain something that is accessible for Alaskans, that's accessible for recreational mushers who really want to put in the time and effort over a few years to qualify and run the race. Michelle and I were talking the other night about the whole issue of competitiveness and withdrawing mushers and pressuring mushers to withdraw when they get too far behind. And I worry that it's going to turn into a race where someone who can't run it in 10 days won't be able to finish. And Michelle had a great idea of doing what the Yukon Quest does and have, you know, a smaller race that's run on the same trail. But I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of changes in the next 5 or 10 years, and part of that also is going to be due to the weather and the climate. And so my fervent hope is that the race continues and that it stays as close to what it is now as we can get it. What's your opinion, from the musher perspective?
I agree with you. I think that they should leave it as pure as possible. And, you know, of course, there's going to be some things added to make it a little bit more 21st century, so to speak. You know, everything's getting faster. Everything's getting more streamlined. There's much more access to everything. But in order for it to stay pure, I think they need to pull back the reins a little bit on that and maybe just not allow as much access as there is. I don't think they can give as much access as they want.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when I first came up to see the Iditarod, I was shocked by how easy it was to pretty much get access to anyone that you wanted. And I had assumed that this would be impossible. So I think it's going to move a little bit away from that. But as you said, that is probably necessary for the ITC to do a lot of the things that they want to do.
Right, I agree with you.
So, Alex, do you have any other news, or are we putting it into our musher profile for this evening?
One quick thing. There was a story a couple days ago, I think, in the Alaska Dispatch News about Martin Boozer, who every year when he stops in Unalakleet, He has Muktuk. Is that how you pronounce it? The Eskimo ice cream, which is my understanding, it's essentially whale blubber and sugar and sometimes something else like blueberries, and is you know, considered a delicacy and something very, very delicious. And the article said that Martin, every year when he comes into Unalakleet, one of the things he looks forward to is that someone will come and meet him and give him Muktuk. And that every year, and Martin's been running this race, I believe, for over 30 years now, and for a long time, every year, the same little girl would come out and give him the Muktuk from year to year. And, of course, she got bigger and bigger and bigger, and then eventually became an adult and moved away from Unalakleet. So now there is someone else who comes out every year, no matter what time he comes in, to bring this to him. And he said that even though he feels bad sometimes when he comes, rolls in at 2 or 3 in the morning, there is always someone there with the Eskimo ice cream to welcome him to Unalakleet. And, you know, it's things like that those little kind of traditions that don't really get a lot of play that I always really love about Iditarod. And it seems that there's just so many of them. And anywhere you look, you can find another little tradition, you know, even if it's just something for one musher.
You know, it is. And I haven't had the privilege of having that that Alaskan dessert yet. I'm looking forward to it. To one day to be able to sample that. But yeah, like you said, there are so many things out there that that people do, whether it's in the villages or, you know, just to pay homage to their fans or to their supporters or their sponsors. There are so many stories out there that we are so concentrated on who's winning and who's losing. Where I think, and just to think about it, as we just talked about that on the previous topic, I think if they spent more time on that, it would help the race so much more than constantly worrying about data, constantly worrying about who's winning, who's losing. Of course, it is a race, but you know, even Sunday Night Football with Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth, they spend a considerable amount of time every broadcast talking about those side stories. The Olympics is based on that. Here, at least in our American coverage, we have, you know, a couple hours a night of the events, but we also have a couple hours every night of those side stories. And I think that's what grows the Olympics. It's not necessarily the competition, because the competition is hours old. You can find out about who won, who lost, within a moment's notice on the internet. But you do not know about what stories they're going to talk about on the nightly coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. I know we're running up against it, so let me jump into our musher profile for this evening. It's Peter Reuter, who is currently in the back of the pack, sort of the very end of Iditarod right now is in Koyuk. There are five mushers there. They've been traveling more or less together, some are a couple hours ahead, some are a couple hours behind, but it's basically Peter, Jimmy Liebling, Al Eichen, Cindy Abbott, and Paul Hansen, and they are all currently resting in Koyuk. And Peter Reuter is 54. He's from New York State, the Adirondack Mountains. It's very interesting because his official musher picture on Iditarod.com, he's got a very full sort of reddish beard in his picture. The beard is now, from the pictures on the trail, the beard is now considerably shorter and trimmed. It also seems to be a little bit grayer, so perhaps the last few months have taken their toll, or it could also be that this is just frost that I'm mistaking for gray. He began mushing recreationally in 1980 with a team of Malamutes. Later, he would give sled dog tours in the Adirondack Mountains. The Adirondacks, for people who didn't grow up in the Northeast, are relatively small by the standards of the West. So I think the biggest mountain in the Adirondack Mountains is probably like 6 or maybe 7,000 feet tall, as opposed to, you know, in the Rockies or Denali, which are much, much taller. He has a degree in forestry, moved to Alaska in 2012. During the summers, he works for Mitch Seedy's Iditarod on the glacier in Girdwood, and he is running a team of dogs from Dean Osmore's Cook Inlet Kennels. He's run races like the Copper Basin 300, the Yukon Quest. This is his rookie run at Iditarod, and he said that he wanted to run this year because he was hoping to do the southern route, and he said that he wanted to run the southern route because people who've run both told him that the southern route has a lot of spirit because it goes through ghost mining towns, and he wanted to experience that. And he said that the southern route is a more technical type of racing, and so he was really very much looking forward to that. And then, of course, it got shifted to Fairbanks. He said before the race that he had an 11-day plan. Looks like he's probably going to finish between 11 and 12 days, so that's pretty great. Most of his dogs have completed either the Iditarod or the Yukon Quest, and so he said that if he doesn't get to Nome, it's all on him because his dogs could definitely do it without him. He said that he thinks it's really neat being an Adirondack kid, and he's calling his racing efforts the Bark Eater Racing Team, which is a throwback to the Adirondacks, and he's hoping in running this race to inspire a lot of the people back where he grew up in New York State to start thinking about sled dogs and sled dog racing more. There used to be a bunch of dog sled races in that area, and now pretty much there aren't very many. There are a few places where they do tours, but aside from that, there's not much where he grew up that's left of dog racing. He said that so far his race has been even more than he hoped for, and he was thinking it would be amazing in terms of the scenery and in terms of getting to spend time with his dogs. He said his dogs are doing extremely well, and he's even been able to run them a little further in some runs than he wanted to. My favorite thing is he went to Paul Smith's College, which is a small college back east. And when he got to Unalakleet, Nancy Person, who's a ski coach, was waiting for him right outside of town with a handwritten cardboard sign that she held up that said, "Welcome to Unalakleet, Paul Smith College Alumni Reunion," because she went there as well. So it's very cool that even, you know, 7,000 miles away from where he grew up and went to school, here he is out on the Iditarod Trail and is able to find someone from his small area of the world, from his past life. So as I mentioned, he is currently in 60th place, and looks like he's got 9 dogs still in his team, and it looks like without too much trouble, he should be in Nome on Saturday.
You know, that's an interesting story when you said that he was 54 and a rookie and has been mushing since 1980. That gives myself a little bit of hope. As you know, Alex, I've been mushing for a long time. I started in 1994 or so, and we moved to Alaska to run Iditarod. So if I can follow in Paul's footsteps, if I run the race when I am 54, I should be right on track to do very well, just like he.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I find, and maybe this says more about me than about the race, but I found this year especially, I've been noticing that there are a lot of people who are rookies who are older, people in their 40s and 50s. And I think back to certainly when I was in college and the idea of someone in their 50s, that seemed impossibly old to me. And now I
right.
think, oh, isn't that great? Here's a guy who's in his mid-50s and is able to do everything he needs to do to run Iditarod, and that gives me a lot of hope too.
It does, you know. I'm looking forward to it. I got 8 years to be able to accomplish that. I think I can get out there and get it done by then. So, Alex, we are just about out of time. We're going to do our show tomorrow at 4 o'clock Alaska time. That will be p.m. on the East Coast and 5 p.m. where you're sitting there in Southern California. Like you said, just about everybody will be in for the banquet on Saturday. Almost always our last show is the night of the banquet. So it'll be Saturday. Or is the banquet Saturday or Sunday, Alex?
I think the banquet's Sunday.
Sunday. Okay. So our last show for our coverage will be on Sunday, and we'll talk about all of the festivities that happen at the banquet. We'll talk about the awards that people have won and sort of the goings on as a wrap up show, like we always do. And I always look forward to Alex's last musher profile here on our Iditarod coverage. It really sets the tone for the off season and, you know, some promising mushers coming up and all the things that are going to be happening over 2017 and 2018. So I look forward to that as well. So who are we talking about tonight before we close?
So tomorrow we'll talk about Al Eichens, who is a really this is his third race, but he is a really fascinating musher, and that's going to be a really good one.
Yeah, he is an interesting character for
sure.
So look forward to hearing about Al, and we will talk tomorrow at 4 o'clock.
How is it?
Okay, thanks, Robert, and welcome back.
Thank you very much. So on behalf of my co-host today, Alex Stein, and for Michelle Forto, for holding down the fort while I was gone, we will see you guys next time. Goodbye.